This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. We have some incredible women on the programme, as per usual, real powerhouses, all of whom have had at some point to stand up and take charge of a situation. What a lineup today. I cannot wait to talk to Sharon Osbourne, who fiercely defends her family and arguably has built her family. She is without a doubt the rock at the centre of it. Also joining me will be Shani Dander, a disability activist who has overcome so much prejudice to become the remarkable and inspirational woman who's just been named the UK's most influential disabled person. And Hannah Peel and Bishy, two of the very few women composing music for screen and pushing for change. Plus, we'll be talking about how nurses are coping with the pressure of the job. All brave, all resilient women who stand up and speak out. So this morning, I want to hear from you about when you have had to stand up for what you believe in. A defining moment in your life, maybe, where you surprised yourself and found the courage to step up, even if you didn't want to, but you did anyway. And you're proud of yourself for doing it, whether it's defending a friend or a family member, getting out of your comfort zone and trying something you never thought you'd be able to do, where you found the courage to really speak your mind, the moment you found your voice. To hell with the consequences. I cannot wait to hear from you all this morning. Get in touch with me in the usual way. The text number is 84844. You can email me by going to our website. You can WhatsApp us or even leave me a voice note if you would like to. It'd be nice to hear someone's voice. 03700 100 444. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us via social media, it's at BBC Woman's Hour. And you never know, if something's chewing you up inside, you may be inspired after this to spit it out, having listened to our incredible lineup of guests. And that text number, once again, 84844. But on to my first guest. For more than two decades, Sharon Osbourne has been a regular feature on our screens. She came to prominence whilst appearing with her husband, Ozzy, on The Osbournes, a reality television show on MTV which followed the family's daily life, I'd say the OG of reality TV shows. She later became a talent show judge on shows such as The X Factor and America's Got Talent. Well, she's just announced dates for a live theatre show entitled Sharon Osbourne Cut the Crap, in which she promises to reveal all about some of the hardest years of her incredibly eventful life, from the anguish of a broken marriage and Ozzy's infidelities to the constant spectre of drug abuse in the family, the loss of friends, betrayal by colleagues, and her ongoing battles with weight, mental health issues. She's going to reveal it all. Well, I'm delighted to say that Sharon joins me now live in the studio. Sharon, welcome to Woman's Hour.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's good. I'm really pleased you're here too. Let's get straight to it. What a great title, Sharon. Cut the crap. It's perfect. Why have you decided to do this? Why now?
It's a good time for me personally. And I'd done it in Canada and Australia and I really enjoyed it. And a producer asked me if I wanted to do it here. And I, Let's give it a go.
Just how honest are you being in the...
There's no point in doing it if you're not going to be totally honest. There's really no point, because then you're just playing games, you know. So just totally honest. And I think that we all have different opinions at different stages of our life, depending how old we are.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about life, you know. You learn from your mistakes. You learn more with age. And it's, you know, I'm quite comfortable talking about anything in my life.
So what stage are you at right now?
The last chapter in my life.
What do you think? Do you think that?
Yeah, you know, I've lived such a full, amazing life. And, you know, we all know nobody lasts forever. And I reckon I'm on my last chapter.
And this last chapter, even though it feels weird saying that, because, you know, it's like we just could go on forever, but is bringing you back after 27 years to the UK. You've lived in America, we know, because we've seen your... We were invited into your home. We'll talk about the Osbournes in a bit and what that did for you, into your very glamorous and unique life that we were all invited into. But you are now coming back to the UK because of Ozzy's health. He's got Parkinson's. So how's he doing? And why did you decide that it was time to leave America?
It's just, you know, as we change over time, so do places. And for me personally, LA has changed, but not for the better. It's not what it used to be. And I just feel uncomfortable there right now. My family will still be there. So we'll go back and forth, I'm sure. But our main place, we've switched it from being in LA to England.
And what will that mean? Do you feel like you're coming home, or do you feel like it's going to be a new start for you?
It's home. It's always been home. I'm not... I don't think I'm very American.
Hmm.
And I just feel more at home here. And it's just time. I miss the culture here, the lifestyle. It just, you know, look at it now at Christmas time. It's magnificent here. It's so special. And, you know, you go and have Christmas in LA. It's sunny. Mm. It's not festive. They've got one dusty old Father Christmas in a sleigh that they dig, the same one they dig out every year and hang it. And it just isn't festive at all.
And I mentioned there that, you know, Ozzy's health, he's got Parkinson's, he's had several operations in recent years following an accident. So how's he doing, and how much of this move is for that reason?
A lot of it is for Ozzy to be able to live with some privacy, because where we live in the countryside, it's not full of paps and, you know, It's not a busy little town, and we have a lot of land, and he'll be able to walk around and pursue his hobbies that he loves doing, and without being bothered.
Hmm.
You know, it's very frustrating for him to, when he goes out or if he wants to go for a walk, even around where we live, followed by paps, and they're always, you know, the pictures always... He doesn't look his best, and then they say, you know, how frail, how long has he got to go? And it's like, it's you lose your dignity somehow.
I said at the beginning, you're a woman who, you know, is the rock of your family. You take charge. I feel like this is you again saying, this is what I need to do for my family. This is what's best for us.
Yeah, it's definitely, I feel what's best for Ozzy right now.
You've been married for over 40 years.
Yeah, can you believe it?
You got together when you took over managing him.
Yeah.
Which we'll discuss. Incredible story as well. What's kept you together all this time? Because it's not been easy.
No, it's not. But I don't think any relationship is easy after a few years. You know, it's you just hope that you all grow together in the same direction. Because after that first initial, you found each other and, you know, the butterflies and can't live without each other, that settles like everything else does. And then you have to, you know, see other qualities in each other. that are just as exciting about respecting each other and people's loyalties in situations. And it's, you have to keep it ever evolving.
Which is true. However, not everyone is married to Ozzy Osbourne, who is, not everyone's married to a rock star, not everyone's married to the kind of the heightened level of things that you've been through. So I'm just fascinated by you and what you have that means that you have the power and the capacity and the resilience to keep going.
It's, I never ever got married to one day be divorced. That was not my thing. I never it wasn't on my wish list to get married. I was quite happy working, being single, loved my work. And it just, I used to think as a younger woman, oh, it's not for me. And it's not my priority in life to get married and have kids. I just love my work. And then, of course, you meet the right person and your opinions and your life changes with that.
And the way you met him, I think, is a real insight into you, which is what I'm interested in today. The real Sharon, who are you and what makes you tick and how you've got to where you are? Because your father used to manage Black Sabbath. He managed a lot of bands, didn't he?
A lot of bands, yeah.
Give us a roll call. Name check some names for us.
Oh, my God. To go back to the Animals, Eric Burdon and the Animals and Electric Light Orchestra, The Move, yeah. Roy Wood, Lindsay DePaul.
This is Don Arden, your father.
Yeah, my dad.
So he's quite a player.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
Quite a character.
Yes.
And then he decided he didn't want to look after Black Sabbath, so you stepped in and said, I'll manage them. Is that how it happened?
I'd first met Ozzy when I was 18. Black Sabbath came into my dad's management office to see if, you know, they could work together, me and my father managing them. And they came in, they had a couple of meetings, and they chose to go with my father's assistants. Well, one of the people was my father's bodyguard and driver, and the other one was his day-to-day assistant. So two guys left my father to take on Black Sabbath's management, and my father thought that he was going to get it.
Right.
So you can imagine that went down terribly with my father and his ego, and you don't think that people are going to do that to you who work for you. Mm. But, you know, it's business. Good luck to them. And Sabbath stayed with them for 9 years. And it ended terribly with lawsuits. Mm. And then I had always kept a relationship because I was on the road touring with Electric Light Orchestra. They were always on the road touring.
Yeah.
And we used to bump into each other occasionally. And so I get this phone call one day from the guitar player Tony Iommi in Sabbath, and he goes, do you think your dad would consider taking us back for management?
Yeah.
And he did.
And then you met Ozzy. And then you came to prominence. We've got to get to the Osbournes when you decided to do brilliant, iconic, like I said, the OG of reality TV shows, where you invited us into your home. How did that affect the family being so publicly scrutinised?
The saving grace was there was no social media at that time.
Yeah.
So it was so different to what it would have been now. And it was a protection for my kids that there was no social media, because you've got to remember the two of them were very young at the time, at a very impressionable age, 15 and 16. So in that way, I'm so relieved. But the reason why we ended it, we loved doing it, and it was a great experience in life for all of us. But it was not doing well for the kids. Mm. And we realised, Ozzy and I realised, that we had to pull the plug and, you know, try and get them back onto a somewhat of a normal life.
Difficult, I imagine.
Very difficult, because when you suddenly, you know, everybody in the world wants to talk to you and think that you're, you know, oh, this family. You know, you, not everybody thought that we were, you know, great, but a lot of people did. Mm. And that's hard to put that down.
Now, you're a very powerful, outspoken woman, and I think that's really important in the public eye, because that's not easy. And people don't often like that, women speaking their minds.
No, they don't.
And you often receive a lot of flack, so how do you deal with it? Go on, have a sip
of
your tea.
Excuse me, I'm having my tea and it's slurping and making noises.
That's what we do. We do that at Woman's Hour. We invite you in and we genuinely do put the kettle on.
Yeah, so, and it's lovely.
And it's in a BBC mug and everything. Yeah, how do you deal with the flack?
I don't let it get to me. And the thing is, if I don't know the people personally who are commenting on me in a bad way, it doesn't mean anything because I don't know them.
Mm.
So I'm not invested in their opinion.
Mm.
So I feel it can't hurt me. But I've learned too that over the years, why look?
Mm.
Why? What are you going to get out of it? So I don't even bother.
I mean, like I said, you are known to be outspoken. You're also fiercely loyal. You're defending your family, but it has caused some controversy. And I'm thinking of the time when you defended Piers Morgan on Twitter when he said he didn't believe Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, in an interview with Oprah. How considered were your comments then? And how well did you cope with the... How well do you cope with backlash when something like that happens?
My take on it was, apart from Piers being a friend of mine, and we'd worked together for a long time, and he gets paid to do a job, and his job is commenting on the news, pop culture, politics, and that's his job. That's what he gets paid for. And he's in that position because he is a very outspoken person.
Mm.
And what he said about Meghan, some of the stuff I agreed with, some I didn't, but he absolutely had a right to do it. Freedom of speech. And that's his profession, to make comments. And
how did you cope with the backlash that you got from standing up for your friend?
It was one of the biggest shocks I've had in my life, just for defending a friend and saying freedom of speech, and then people saying, well, Piers is racist. That's why he's saying these things about Meghan. They're not true, and it's, you know, it's racism. So if you're supporting Piers, you must be a racist too. And it's like, how do you get that one? How does this end up racism?
Mm.
You know, he's making comments about... He's making remarks on comments that Meghan is stating, her statements. And that's what he gets paid to do, comment.
Now, I described you as a rock for your whole family, which you are. And we know you're super protective. A lot of women listening to this can relate to that. Where do you get your support from?
Myself. Yeah, myself.
Where does that come from?
I think it's a sense of survival. Always working in an industry that was run by men.
Yeah.
And an industry that is a very tough industry for women. And at the time that I started in management, there were no women managers in the music industry.
Mm.
And it was very, very hard to have a voice. Well, even anybody wanted to listen to you. Nobody did. And so it was a case of me. The only way I could deal with the industry and the hardness of it was to be harder.
And I bet there's a lot of women who know that. When you just have to defend, support yourself and have only got yourself. But isn't it exhausting, Sharon?
It's absolutely exhausting. And when you go into a boardroom of men and, you know, we're talking about marketing campaigns and how much they cost and this, that and the other. And one of the guys that was one of the heads of, it was CBS Records at the time, said to me, I've just had my suite of offices done. Do you want to come and look in the kitchen?
Mm.
Kitchen, why? And he said, oh, I thought it would be of interest to you in my office suite. And I go, well, actually, I don't cook, so no, I don't want to see it. And it was a case of somebody being not knowing what to say in a meeting to a woman manager and being embarrassed. And it's just like, why do I want to see your kitchen? Because I'm a woman, I want to see a kitchen.
It's amazing that you're able to just stand up for yourself back then as well. It's one of those, we are running out of time quickly, but I need to ask you, because you have done so much and you've said, you know, final chapter, I feel like there's still so much for you to say. And you know what I'm really enjoying? I feel like because we see you on TV, we've seen you in these sort of heightened TV setups, it's almost like how much of this is real, how much of it is the caricature of Sharon. And I feel that this, maybe this last chapter that you've talked about, we're going to get a bit of this, you know, this, like the reality of what it means, what it's taken to be you. Spoken so publicly about so much stuff. We've seen you live your life. We know your family. You've survived and come through colon cancer. You're now coming back to the UK for the benefit of your husband. You know, you've said yourself, you know, you defend on yourself. What the strength you must have is remarkable. Do you have any regrets?
Of course I do. I have regrets. But what can you do? The only thing you can do is learn from them and hope that you don't do the same things again. But yeah, of course I have regrets, many.
Well, Sharon, good luck with the tour. I know you're going to Birmingham as well, which is a very important city for you. And thank you so much for coming in.
No,
you're going to have to come back.
I would love to. I would really love to.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, thank you too.
84844 is the number to text. And a lot of you getting in touch saying, lovely to hear Sharon. When I was a young news presenter in 1981, I hosted Ozzy for tea while he waited for his studio call. He was quiet, gentle, witty, and an absolute delight to spend time with. Please wish them both well. And that's from Merrin. And a lot of you getting in touch with things that you've done to empower yourself. Many years ago, I worked for a boss who never used my name. He called me sweetheart instead. One day I said, if you call me that one more time, I shall call you my lover, no matter the circumstances. He never did it again. Well done, Sue. And Marlene says, I once intervened on a bus when a group of teenage boys were taunting an old man. I knew I could not take them on, so I just went and sat quietly by him and shielded him from the horrible things they were saying to him. I felt compelled to act. 84844 is the number to text. Keep your messages coming in about anything you're listening to on the programme today. Now, new data from the Royal College of Nursing today is warning of a growing mental health crisis amongst nursing staff. Calls to its membership support line have shown a substantial increase in the number of nursing staff seeking help for having suicidal thoughts. With 2 months left of the 2023 to report, the number of members self-declaring that they're experiencing these mental health concerns has increased from 113 cases in the whole of 2022 to 176 cases. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Stephen Jones, the lead for mental health and interim head of nursing practice at the RCN, to unpick what the nursing union believe lies behind this increase. But first, let's hear from Hannah, a nurse currently working in palliative care. She gave her response to the RCN's findings.
I think for myself, you know, as somebody who has a history of serious mental illness and tried to take my own life in 2009, so was nearly part of the statistics of a nurse taking their own life, I feel sad that this is what we're hearing, that there is an increased number. There's another part of me that's also thinking, is it because nurses feel like they can say to the Royal College of Nursing that they are having these thoughts as well? And certainly when I look back to when I was sectioned under the Mental Health Act in 2007, certainly there wasn't any talk about nurses who were having suicidal thoughts, nurses who were taking their own life. It was not something that I was hearing at that time. And I remember feeling really alone, that I was this nurse that was this real failure who was struggling. So I don't know whether there's also this hopeful thing that people are beginning to feel that at the Royal College of Nursing, they feel they're able to say. But I think on the wider aspect, I still don't think it is easy to say. And I've made the decision to be really open, which I have been since about 2016, that I am a nurse who tried to take my own life. And that's come with all sorts of responses. And I think there still is a stigma out there in being able to talk about it. And I think there's a self-stigma as well, because you think, I'm the person that cares. And it's really hard as nurses to say, actually, I need a bit of care because actually I'm human and I have struggles and I have difficulties. And I think that we also need to be careful as well about why there is this increase, because every single case will be unique and different to that particular nurse. And I think we need to understand why this is happening, I think, and what's happening for different people. Because certainly people would often ask me if it was the nursing. And sadly for me, it was actually my childhood that had caused my difficulties. And that meant that I needed to look after that side of myself before I could then return to nursing. But I think what we're also realizing as well is that certainly I can see a difference. So I had to step out of nursing in 2007. It took quite a long time for my treatment, but I was able to return to nursing in 2020, which was an interesting time to return because it was the pandemic. But in returning, I did see a difference between how many nurses were then looking after how many patients, and it had increased. And I think there is this, what we're now calling, and the Royal College of Nursing is now calling, this moral distress, whereas nurses, we're feeling that we're not able to give the care that we would like to give patients. And that, I think, is causing nurses as well to feel that kind of pain, really, of not being able to give what they can give to your patients. I certainly know where I work, the hospice that I work in, so I'm a palliative care nurse now, that I often do night shifts, and I will often look after a patient who's distressed at night. And, you know, when a patient's distressed, you want to sort of sit with that patient. And so I will sit with that patient, and I've got my hand on their hand so that they know I'm there. And then my other hand is writing my notes. And then in my pocket is the phone for the community, because we take the phone overnight for the community patient. And that's what you're then trying to do is manage all these things, because you know that actually at that moment in that time is actually how important it is to sit with that patient. And I think it's those sort of things that can be hard as more and more pressure is put onto nurses.
Yeah, but not everyone's writer. So I'm joined now by Stephen from the Royal College of Nursing. Now, Stephen, is there more and more pressure being put onto nurses? Let's get into this. What's going on?
Thank you. So just to give a bit of context before we start. So in May of this year, our members voted to mandate the RCN to lobby the government for the implementation of an integrated suicide prevention programme for the nursing workforce across the UK. So we already know that female nurses are 23% more at risk of suicide compared to the general population. And that was really something that underpinned the need to mandate the college to respond. So with regards to what's causing it, it's like Hannah mentioned, every case is individual. I think when we talk about suicide and even suicidal thoughts, which is what we're talking about with our data, is we need to be very sensitive and understand it can be complex. There are different reasons, not all work-related. There are home-related issues as well. But we do know that persistent understaffing, the intolerable pressures that the workforce is facing, that financial insecurity at home as well, are contributing factors we know have started to emerge or have been emerging for some time with other pieces of work that have been done. So for us, with this data, for one, it came about as part of the programme of work that we've been doing in response to that item that was shared at Congress. And as I say, we were mandated to move forward. Mm. And for us, we just wanted to really have a look to see, well, what's happening amongst our workforce, what's happening amongst our members, what are they telling us? And when we looked to see the prevalence or at least the number of times suicide came up, it was really concerning to see that there was a clear trend, an increase. And another statistic, so if we look at October 2 years ago, we had roughly one person a week sharing suicidal ideation with us. 2 years later, last October, it's almost one a day. Wow. So there is a change, and there's a serious issue we need to respond to. So I think with that issue of complexity, for us, it's really important we know what's going on, we understand where the issues are for our members. So as I said,
so what is going on?
So I don't want to speculate now, other than we know there are the broad issues that I've already mentioned. But for us, it's we're commissioning or have started to commission research to deep dive into that data, to really unpick the context, to know are there particular groups who are presenting more and expressing these issues. So we do want to look at the impact on marginalised groups as well, and also other key demographics. There's age, there's gender, as we know, is an issue, but it's really important to pull out to find out what's happening.
How easy is it for nurses to find support?
It varies. There is support available, and I think listening to Hannah's talk, and Hannah's absolutely brilliant, extremely inspirational, and keeps us all in check as well at the OCN to make sure that we focus on that lived experience, which is fantastic. But with regards to support, there is always support. There's always support available. And I think that message of hope needs to be front and centre. Suicide is preventable. That's a key message. But also, you're never alone. There's always, as I say, that help available. For the OCN members, we have a member support service where you have counselling as part of that. There's financial support, access to hardship grants. So there's a well-rounded package of support that can be offered. But also for non-OCN members, again, there's access to grants. OCN Foundation offer grants. The Cavell Trust offer grants as well. So with regards to the actual support for intervention, it varies. It is a bit of a postcode lottery, and we do know that. We have seen the closure of the hubs that were the wellbeing hubs that were set up during the pandemic.
During the pandemic, yeah. And yeah. How many are still, and they've been closing?
They have been closing. Not sure. I think we mentioned the exact number. There were 42 and there's quite a few have closed.
So what needs to happen to ease this situation? How much of it comes down to needing to employ more nurses?
Fundamentally, that's a core issue. So Hannah mentioned this issue of moral distress. And what we found in the pandemic is when language is so important, and we work in a diverse workforce as well. And sometimes there's that pathologizing language, that diagnostic terminology doesn't always sit well with people, particularly when you're working in an environment that is extremely stressful. There is bullying and harassment that occurs, and you're constantly under pressure. That actually, by making it about an individual, you sometimes remove that context. So the whole idea of moral distress emerged, as I say, through the pandemic, where there was a pushback to say, I don't want to be diagnosed with the mental illness or a mental health problem. Actually, it's the workplace that's the problem. So this issue of moral distress is fundamentally where nurses know the right thing to do, ethically and morally, but are constrained from doing that. So it's providing the best care possible. It's being able to offer the holistic needs. So there's a lot of moral and ethical issues that can occur. So although we can look at that external offer and that external offer of counselling, therapy, that formal support needs to be there. There's still a lot more to do with regards to organisational culture, team level culture.
Fundamental easing the pressure of the job.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yes, without a doubt, we need more nurses. There is a workforce plan that's now available that really needs to be properly funded and pushed forward, while also being aware of the change in demand. Demand has increased across the board, and we need to be able to react to that. So although government's committed to the workforce plan now, still needs to be reviewed and updated as the years move forward.
Is it only nurses experiencing this? What do we know about other healthcare professionals?
No, it's beyond nurses. I think generally the two highest groups that have been identified are nurses and doctors. So doctors too face the same issue with regards to the pressures across the board. It affects everybody within the health service. And as well, it's affecting a lot of people in the general population. You know, this and although, as I say, we're talking about suicidal thoughts here, we're talking about that suicidal ideation, which is another word for it. We know suicide, attempted suicide, or completed suicide has a huge impact on many, many people around the person. So it's not just about the individual who's been in that situation and has sadly gone through that, but actually all those left behind, all those loved ones. So it's a massive societal population health issue. It can't be just pigeonholed in a mental health thing. It's for all of us to understand and respond to.
And so back to what's happening with nurses, what will the next steps be now that you've seen this indicator and the calls are coming in and there is a rise? What are the next steps?
Yeah, so as I said, we've commissioned research to deep dive into our data so that we can really pull out context and know what the real issues are, what our members are saying are the causes, but also see what's worked, what's helped. Are people wanting to access the counselling side of things? Are they looking for other forms of support? Part of what we do with our programme is engage with key stakeholders. We had recently a summit with all the strategic leads of the four nations of the UK to come together. And there is some excellent work going on. There is real passion and strong policy documents. We've endorsed NHS England's suicide prevention toolkit, which gives really clear aims and advice on how organisations can move things forward. Sure. But it's the implementation that's important. So we can have all these documents, all these policies, but it has to reach the ground.
Absolutely. Stephen Jones, thank you so much for coming in to speak to me. That's Stephen, who's the lead for mental health and interim head of nursing practice at the Royal College of Nursing. And we've had a statement from an NHS spokesperson who said nurses remain a vital and extremely valued part of the NHS workforce. Supporting staff wellbeing is central to the NHS long-term workforce plan. And £2.3 million has been made available to maintain support for staff through mental health hubs alongside a wider set of health and wellbeing interventions, such as a range of counselling and talking therapy options. And a Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, "We're hugely grateful to NHS staff for their invaluable work, and their health and wellbeing is paramount. That's why all NHS staff, including nurses, can access physical and mental health support and advice, including targeted psychological support and treatment. Mental health and wellbeing hubs also provide NHS colleagues quick access to assessment and local mental health services where needed." Once again, Stephen, thank you very much. Now, Dr. Shani Danda is a disability inclusion and accessibility specialist, social entrepreneur and broadcaster. This month, she was named the UK's most influential disabled person by the Shaw Trust as part of the Disability Power 100, nominated by the public and judged by an independent panel. The first woman of colour to get the honour. Not bad for a Brummie lass who had over 100 job applications turned down at just 16. Shani is also an ambassador for disability charity Scope, with a member of a regional panel advising the disability unit of the Cabinet Office. Wednesday's autumn statement was controversial in its announcements affecting sick and disabled people, with the government claiming their changes would support more people in work and campaigners saying they could make the situation worse. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a lot of things. But first of all, Shani, welcome to Woman's Hour. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How did it think about that 16-year-old who had 100 job applications turned down and now here you are?
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. Would never have imagined the journey that I've been on. But it's a huge title and it comes with huge responsibility. But I'm really chuffed for the recognition.
We are going to talk about you because it's really important that people hear your story and know exactly who you are. But let's start with the autumn statement, because it has been announced, series of announcements made by the Chancellor, including pensions going up by 8.5%. Now the dust has settled, what do you think it means for disabled people and disabled women in particular?
I think it's a really counterproductive approach. We also have to remember that prior 2020, remote and hybrid work was the exclusion, not the rule. And I think what's been most frustrating is, you know, I actually left a workplace because of the lack of ability to make the adjustments that I needed, which was flexibility in work. And, you know, employers and government were like, no, you know, you can't work remotely. This is all pre-pandemic. Because if we do it for you, disabled person, then we've got to do it for everybody else. Or, oh, what about data protection, for example? And then as soon as lockdown came, like that, it happened overnight. And I think what I learned from that was change can happen in society and very quickly, but it only happens when it suits the majority. And now that same message is being given to some disabled people that genuinely, because of their condition or impairment, cannot work. And they're being sanctioned to go and find jobs that just do not exist. So it's very counterproductive and a really harmful rhetoric.
Well, and we're going to talk about your story and your lived experience, but just to say, we have had a statement from a spokesperson from the Department of Work and Pensions who said, we're committed to supporting disabled women through the benefit system. Our chance to work guarantee will give the most vulnerable the opportunity to try to work without fear of losing benefits. This is part of this government's landmark welfare reform, which include our £2.5 billion plan to help thousands of people with disabilities and health conditions who can work, find jobs and fulfil their potential. Let's go back to what we started with. When you were 16, you applied for 100 jobs. And what happened?
I didn't hear back from any of the applications that I made. And I had one sentence in my covering letter. You know, it said, I've got a condition, but it doesn't affect my ability to do this role. And I now look back on that time and I can't believe how naive I was. I was just not prepared for the amount of stigma that exists in society, just generally about disabled people, but also as us, as valuable members of the workplace. Now, I have a very visible condition. I have a short stature. And when people say to me, well, why did you even put it on your covering letter in the first place? I was doing it to help my prospective employer feel less awkward, because there is huge awkwardness about disability, and I see people's very visceral response when they first meet me. Mm. People sometimes don't really know what to do, or perhaps will avoid a conversation with me. So I was doing it thinking, oh, this will be great, you know, I'm being really proactive, really proud of my identity, not knowing it was completely going against me. So, you know, after feeling really deflated, after over 100 job applications, I thought, you know, I can work, I want to work, and I want to contribute to society. Why aren't I getting an opportunity? So I took that one sentence off and I got offered an interview and I got a job straight away. Mm. And it, honestly, to this day, I think it's been one of the most harsh life lessons that I've had to learn. But that then, in turn, made me realise that I could not go throughout life like this. And I thought, well, how can I take control of the situation? And that was by creating my own opportunities.
Because we're going to talk, facing that level of discrimination, having that harsh life lesson at such a young age, and it built you and it made you make a decision about how you wanted to go forwards. But that discrimination that does, we know, exists within society, actually for you exists on many levels, because like me, you come from a Punjabi family. So for you, the discrimination starts within your own culture, right?
Absolutely. And that's because disability faces an even further sense of stigma in South Asian communities. So I've often played the role of an educator, not only between my parents, my family, my local community. But I did have a really unique upbringing. You know, yeah. I went to a special needs primary school, and then on the weekends, as a family, we'd be coming down to London to protest for Sikh rights. Like, that's such a unique perspective. Like, in the week I was institutionalized, and then on the weekend, you know, I was fighting for other people's rights and my community's rights. Mm. And drawing on the principles of Sikhism, I think my parents have been the best example. They've always sort of said, you know, if you can help others, do that. If you can be a voice for others, do that. But I had to do that for me first, and I had to find my own voice. And I guess I'm still on a journey of doing that. It's not by nowhere sort of a finished product.
And you are doing it. You're on a journey to find your voice, standing up for what you believe in and advocating for others. And you're an activist. But what was the experience like for your mum having you as a baby?
Yeah, so I'm a middle child, the second daughter, and my mum had some really awful treatment and behaviour. So when I was born, there was nothing picked up in the scan. So, you know, it was a shock to everyone that I was born with a rare genetic condition. But I didn't get my diagnosis straight away. It came at the age of two. And my mum faced comments such as, you know, not only have you had another girl, but she's disabled. And that hurt me so much when I heard it, not too long ago, actually. And I couldn't understand why in that moment somebody would feel that that was an appropriate thing to say. I can't imagine what my parents themselves must have been feeling and going through, especially not even knowing the name of my condition at that point. Mm. It's been tough, but you know, my mum's been an amazing source of strength for me, and she's never treated me any differently from my siblings. And I think if she had, she would have been setting me up to fail, Because life's hard, right? It's hard for everybody. But it's even harder when you live in a world that isn't designed for you and you look very different as well. You know, my reality is that there are more clothes designed for dogs than me. There's nowhere I can go to buy clothes for my body type because I have a short stature. But, you know, she is an amazing source of strength. And she just kind of helped me figure out that, yeah, you might not be able to do things in the average way, but you'll always find a way around it. And that's just what I've applied to everything in life.
So your strength comes from your mum. What's mum's name? We need to name check mum.
My mum's name's Val, but her home name is Baby.
I love that. Of course she's called Baby. Brilliant. Perfect nickname. How do you feel about your success now? Do you feel secure in it? Because you moved to London, living your life, you know, getting all these accolades. You're Dr. Shani Dunder now. How do you feel about it all?
None of this was ever planned. I've done everything I've done really out of necessity and still continue to do so. And everything I'm doing is to create a space and change that I wish existed for me when I was growing up. You know, it's led me to create spaces like the Asian Woman Festival, the Asian Disability Network, and I have, you know, I have the privilege of really working with loads of the world's biggest brands to really help them on their journey of disability inclusion. But it's all happened really organically, so a lot of the time I am sitting there thinking, is this my life? Is this me? Is that the same girl that went to that special needs primary school and everybody around her had the lowest expectations? But I think, you know, I've always been really determined. And I, at 16, when that employment experience happened, I kind of made a promise with myself because it was a really pivotal age for me. My health had finally stabilised. So it was like my first glimpse of freedom and just being able to live and my body somewhat cooperate with me. And I just made a promise that I never wanted to live with regrets and I wanted to make every day count. And I feel really happy to say that I've done that. And I'm just here to make life a bit less difficult for other over-excluded people as well.
Good Friday. Over-excluded people. Dr. Shani Dunder, thank you so much for coming to Woman's Hour to speak to me. More power to you.
Thank you.
Keep going. Now, women composers working in the film, TV and gaming industries are rare. This month, the report, Female Professionals in European Film Production 2023, revealed only 10% of European film composers are women. In 2019, research from Counting the Music Industry found that only 14% of TV and film composers signed to UK music publishing companies were women. And this year's GameSoundCon Audio Industry Survey, women game composers and sound engineers made up a whopping 15% of the industry. So where are all the women and why aren't they breaking through? This week, the F-List, a website with a searchable source of women composers, has appointed a new president, the Ivor Novello winning composer-producer Hannah Peel, and another talent, the composer Bishy, has released her latest EP. Both Hannah and Bishy join me now to discuss this. Welcome, both of you. Congratulations, Hannah. Big job.
Thank you.
Tell us just to remind us what the F-List is. What's the purpose?
It's a community now with over 6,000 musicians, songwriters, composers. It's a source of information for commissioners and labels and all female, I might add. But it's not just that. They do a lot of research. They put on events. It's an incredible tool for making awareness of our amazing UK talent.
And I've got I've got two of you. You're on Zoom, I have to say, look, with the beautiful instruments around you. Where are you, by the way?
I'm in Northern Ireland.
Well, one of the UK talents is sitting in front of me, Bishy. So many stark facts and figures. We're going to get into those. But I came to see the launch of your EP this week, which was magnificent. It's your first composing gig.
Yeah, this is my first soundtrack.
And it's for a VR video game called Maya, which sounds incredible. I can't wait to experience it. It's about a menstruating superhero. I think we should hear some of it. So we got the electronic bit there, but what I need to say is there's Rebecca, who plays violin, and you on your sitar, and you sing over it as well. It's incredible. Tell us how you went about making it.
Well, when you're working in VR, everything has to be determined. They're very strict. There aren't many edits. So I would work with rough kind of VR, sort of pre-VR animated rushes. And I sit in my studio. I've got my sitar, my tanpura, analog keyboard, my piano, a bunch of soft synths. And I also do a lot of vocal layering. So I tend to make choirs out of my voice. And it's really visceral. As soon as I see the rushes, as soon as I see moving picture, I hear music in my head. I know exactly what to write.
And it is incredible. The whole experience was just magic. You've been around for a long time doing extraordinary things, performing and making music. Why do you think it's taken this long for you to get your first job doing a soundtrack?
Yeah, well, the filmmakers, Polomi Basu, who is a Bengali artist and human rights activist, and co-directed with CJ Clark. And I think it's taken, well, I mean, my first gigs have been South Asian people who have commissioned me. I'm currently working on a Channel 4 documentary series, a South Asian film director. Yeah, I think it's taken a long time for people to start to embrace inclusion and diversity in the music composition, production, and in the all-round arts. Since 2020, it's become an absolute must. Since the second, what is arguably the second human rights sort of movement, you know,
yeah,
in terms of inclusion and diversity, and people understanding that it not only impacts people culturally, but it's going to impact them economically, and companies are going to be better off from having composers, artists, you know, an employment force from a much wider perspective.
Hannah, I'm going to bring you in here because you, as well as being a composer, you're a presenter on Radio 3. Earlier this year, you won an Ivor Novello Award for Best Television Soundtrack. Well done you. Congratulations. You're just the second woman to have achieved this in 67 years.
Isn't that insane? So mental. And solo, yes.
Solo, yes. I should add.
And there's been lots of nominations and duos that have won with a female composer within that. But yeah, solo artist, which is just insane. I couldn't believe it when Vic, who runs the F List, actually told me only a couple of weeks ago. I was like, wow, that's just madness.
So a lot of work to do. And I want to talk to you a bit more about this in a minute, but I think we should hear some of your music as well. This is a creation that has been recognised. This was recognised. It was Ward 300 from the Midwich Cuckoos. Let's have a listen. Love it, Hannah. Tell us about that. What is it? What were we listening to?
We've gone for the darkest of the dark.
Yeah, I specifically requested it for a Friday morning. Go on.
The creepiness, and it's a beautiful sunny day here, so it just feels even more surreal. But you know, I guess like the Midwich Cuckoos was kind of approached as a sunlit horror, so it fits quite well. But it was for a Sky TV show, TV series, based on the original John Wyndham novel, and it came out last year or the year before actually now, so it feels, time is moving fast. But the soundtrack itself was analog synths and sounds and a lot of emphasis on production rather than, you know, string scoring and things like that.
I think we should name check some of the women, because we are talking about women and so few women, but there are some women out there as well as the two of you doing some incredible work. So I'm just going to name check a few. Obviously, Delia Derbyshire did the theme for Doctor Who. There's Nanita Desai, Debbie Wiseman, who's been on Woman's Hour. She did the soundtrack to Wolf Hall. There's Jessica Curry. So there are women out there, but, you know, the percentages that I gave at the top, they're not great, are they? Hannah, why are there so few women doing what you do? Where are they all?
I don't know. do you know, it's one of those things that I've wanted to do for a very, very long time. Like what Bishi was saying, you know, when I graduated, I tried to get into a master's degree. And the kind of the course that you would have took back then was you would have gone to done a degree at a college, and then you would have maybe been a composer assistant. There wasn't this kind of notion at the moment where you develop yourself as an artist, and then a lot of the production companies at the moment really want artists and their individual sounds. So it's only in the last 4 or 5 years that I've been able to do it, and that my opportunity came from a female director called Jeannie Finley, who's an incredible documentary maker, And like what Bishi was saying, it was more like the female directors and producers were hiring me because there was a change in the industry. But why is, I think there was just a lack of awareness, a lack of opportunity. It's an industry that moves very, very fast, has a lot of money in it as well. So, you know, people were probably choosing composers that they'd used before, their friends, and also people that could, they thought could do it fast and trust. You know, it's a lot of money on the line with productions and things these days, especially.
Well, what does pay and how much time are you asked to put in?
I mean, you could work for games, you can work years on a soundtrack, but for film, it could be from a couple of weeks to maybe 4 or 5 months, maybe longer. But TV, I would say from initial conception until the end result, 6 to 8 months usually, if you're lucky. But that delivery time is very short. You know, you're delivering episodes every kind of 2 weeks at a push, and that's writing, editing, mixing, everything. So it is fast work, and it's long, long hours. It's not, some people, it's just not suitable for everybody.
Of course. So. Bishi.
Yeah, well, I mean, like absolutely echoing Hannah. I mean, I'm a newbie in this area and I'm absolutely loving it and I love the process, but it is really fast and really intense work. And you're like, oh yeah, my schedule's evened out a bit, which means I can stop at 6 p.m, not at 10 p.m, you know.
How typical, I mean, look, Bishi's route into it, you know, how, but actually let me ask both of you, because we are running out of time and it's really important, I think, because there will be brilliant musicians listening to this who would love to compose something. What advice would you give them?
Keep releasing. That was my key. And people mock me for that. Keep making music, keep releasing. And I think it's similar for you, Hannah, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely essential to have your sound and your unique approach to music, because that is what people are wanting to buy these days. And it makes a difference. The soundtracks are original and unique. But yeah, this is part of a much larger conversation of what younger musicians and aspiring film composers could do. But that was my route as well.
Well, keep doing what you're doing, and we can't wait to hear more work from you and keep inspiring the next generation. I just want to end the programme with some of the messages, because we've had so many people get in touch. Jenny's been in touch to say, and Shani's still in the studio, she says, I loved hearing Shani speak. My son is autistic, and until I had him, I never knew how much the world is not built for people with disabilities. We need to elevate and amplify the voices of people like Shani, here, who speak from lived experience, because in 2023 there should be no excuse for not meeting the needs of the needs of huge numbers of people. And also, we did have a very frank discussion about mental health in nursing. I must let you know that there are support links on our website. If you do need them, please go to our website. That's it from me. Join me tomorrow. Thank you to all my guests. I'll be back tomorrow with Weekend's Woman's Hour. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hello, this is Marion Keyes.
And this is Tara Flynn.
We host a podcast you might like for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds called Now You're Asking.
Each week we take real listeners' questions about life,
love,
lingerie,
cats,
dogs,
dentists,
pockets,
or the lack of
anything really,
and apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help,
but also hopefully entertain. Join us, why don't you?
Search up Now You're Asking
on BBC Sounds.
Tankin' you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing, So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.